members of the Hogan family and distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honour as a former student of Warren Hogan to be invited to give this lecture in his memory, and I thank the family and the School of Economics at the university for giving me that honour. I want to come to a couple of personal reminiscences of Warren Hogan. Before that, let me say that the written version of my text has some of the biographical details, but I'm not going to read that out because I think Tony's done a better job than I could of recounting much of Warren's career. So I'm going to not cover that, but go to the later material in my address. Suffice to say that he had an extensive career, very active program of publications, and he ranged very broadly. One thing that I do want to note is that as early as 1958, which was the year I was born, Warren Hogan was producing articles examining the rise of new financial intermediaries outside the regulated banking system. When I joined the Reserve Bank in 1980, we were still hearing that theme, and indeed it's a theme which ought to resonate today as we focus a lot on so-called shadow banks and as we see an expansion of the weight and the width of the global regulatory footprint underway, as indeed we do. Warren retained an interest in financial regulation and deregulation throughout his career, and he married that with a very nuanced understanding of the behaviour of financial institutions in their appetite for risk, and that is something to which I want to come back later on. It was in my third year at Sydney University, which would have been in 1978, that I think I first encountered Professor Hogan. More than three decades after I sat in the afternoon seminars in that awful room in Merriweather, which is much less salubrious than this one, let me assure you, I remember more his general style than I remember exactly what it was he said. He was usually dressed in a suit, as I recall, and that would have been much more unusual for an academic in 1978 than it would be now. And the reason for that was probably that he'd been in the city earlier in the day because, as Tony said, he was active in dealing with practical policy issues and he had links with the business world. And on some days, there might have been a nice lunch in the city. And on those days, there was, we could say, a certain relaxed expansiveness to his demeanour in the afternoon. He would often speak without notes about whatever it was we were talking about, and as he did, he would one by one take the coins from the waistcoat pocket, and some of my classmates will remember this, and he would put them in little piles on the desk. While he spoke, we wondered what subconscious portfolio balance behaviour this represented. He had a somewhat elliptical way of saying things sometimes, and you had to listen very carefully to get what it was he was really saying, and you sometimes weren't clear whether you'd really understood correctly. As I think back on that characteristic, I wonder whether he missed a calling as a central banker, actually. He certainly had built up contacts in the central banking world as a visitor to the BIS in Basel, a place where I frequently go these days. And he was on very good terms with the late Palashelda Anderson, who was a renowned BIS economist and a student of the international economy and financial system. I assume that that acquaintance was made in the late 70s when Pala visited the University of Sydney for a period, and I remember him being there, banging away on his typewriter early in the morning. He was a prolific writer, and he was, of course, funded by a grant from the RBA to make that visit. So I assume that he and Warren became friends, and I think they were quite good friends as a result of that interaction. One Hogan paper of that era that I really remember quite well, or at least I remembered its title, it struck a chord with me. It was about the issue of revisions to economic statistics. And it was called, How Do We Know Where We're Going When We Don't Know Where We've Been, Let Alone Where We Are? I've always remembered that title, and as I came to be a frequent user of economic statistics in my job, I've always remembered it. These days, the quality of national accounts data are much better than they were then. It's also true these days that central banks put huge effort into what has come to be called nowcasting, as opposed to forecasting. So nowcasting is working out what the national accounts will, or should anyway, say when they're released in 2 or 3 months from now about what the economy is presently doing. Some central banks actually backcast. They work out their own version of GDP, what it should have been, and put that out, the Bank of England being case in point. We don't do that. I'm often tempted to write down what I think the figures should say, but we have, of course, seen this year even the issue of trying to establish what the actual recent core inflation rate was, because we've seen some material revisions to the data that that help us evaluate that. So Hogan was onto something here quite a long time ago in the mid-70s. But the work I want to focus on in a little bit more length this evening is in a different sphere, and it's the book that Warren Hogan co-authored with Ivor Pierce called The Incredible Eurodollar. This is actually quite a topical little book. It was published initially in 1982 and subsequently updated in 83 and 84. And it sought to explain the workings of the Eurodollar market and the institutions which operated in that market. In the 1970s, which was of course their data set when they wrote this book, the Eurodollar markets were an exotic new development. They were spawned by a period of international financial turmoil and innovation in most respects every bit as great as what we see now. And some of that innovation was in response to regulation. The backdrop, as many of you will no doubt recall, was that the post-World War II compact, known as the Bretton Woods system, had held for about 20 or 25 years. That system involved a US dollar standard under which countries fixed their currency, occasionally adjusted their currency to the US dollar. The US dollar was fixed to gold at $35 an ounce. Private capital flows in those days were quite limited in scope. And official flows made major contributions through IMF programs to international adjustment. But by the late 60s or early 70s, that arrangement had come under severe strain. Private capital flows had become much larger, and US policymakers in particular found that they could not live within the constraints that that system required and the constraints that it put on them. And so in a sequence of events, which included the break of the link with gold in 1971, and the decision by key countries to allow their currencies to float against the dollar, that system broke down. It was replaced by a system in which exchange rates between what were then the major currencies were allowed to float, as they have ever since, with only occasional efforts at managing those rates. The Eurodollar market was in essence a pool of obligations issued by banks outside the US jurisdiction, but denominated in dollars. It grew rapidly, apparently unconstrained by regulation which was conducted on a national basis, as all regulation was then and largely still is. It was part of a large increase in cross-border financing activity by internationally active banks. When Hogan and Pierce published this book, their last edition in 1984, the stock of cross-border assets held by banks which reported these obligations to the BIS, which publishes the data, that stock of cross-border assets was about $2 trillion. Today, that stock is $32 trillion. It's grown a lot. In the early 80s, a lot of the talk about the euro-dollar markets was couched in terms of whether these euro-dollar deposits ought to be added to some measure of money supply, and you'll remember that measures of money supply were all the rage at that time. This was the period in which the US Federal Reserve was targeting monetary aggregates and in which weekly data on monetary aggregates were scrutinised with a fine-tooth comb every week to try to detect the likely direction of US interest rates. And so you can see that background actually in the language that Hogan and Pierce used in that book. Of course, it was only a few years later that most countries gave up the attempt to define money or to conduct their policy in terms of monetary aggregates, instead going back to the former model of setting a short-term interest rate, which, of course, we still largely have here. It's interesting, though, that in recent years, the so-called zero lower bound for nominal interest rates, which as students we learned about as the liquidity trap, has gone from being a curiosum in the textbook from a bygone era to actually a binding constraint in a number of major countries. And one implication of that, among others, has been that calibrating monetary policy in terms of monetary quantities has come back into vogue in some countries, albeit this time with the relevant central banks consciously seeking to increase money rather than to reduce it. Whether the relationship between money and nominal GDP or prices turns out to be any more reliable than it was 25 years ago, when it wasn't very reliable, of course, remains to be seen. If the language in Hogan and Pierce's early 80s work is a product of its time, I would say that some of the observations in that book are quite astute, and there were some quite prescient insights which are relevant to what we've seen in recent years. To begin with, we could note, as Hogan and Pierce did, that the activities of these euro currency markets and indeed of private cross-border financing generally lessened the pressure on countries to adjust to current account imbalances, particularly when they were running a deficit. Now, you could say that's good in that it allows capital to flow more effectively and smoothly to places where the rate of risk-adjusted return was highest. Or you could decide that it was worrying the markets, in a sense, giving countries more rope, so to speak, with which to hang themselves, and allowing current account imbalances to become larger and more persistent than they would otherwise have done. Remember that when Hogan and Pierce wrote this book, current account positions for most serious countries had rarely been more than a few percentage points of GDP for any length of time, at least since the Second World War. Well, their analysis of a mythical planet called Hetraea, which is Earth spelt backwards, had three countries, Surplusia, Deficitia, and Balancia, that issued currencies called SERPs, DEFs, and BALs. And that analysis focused on the operation of markets and, importantly, the role of financial intermediaries as intermediating between savers in one country and borrowers in another. In language that we might use today, financial institutions were key and are key in this story to the dynamics of the so-called global imbalances. Indeed, Hogan and Pierce state quite bluntly, and I quote, "financial intermediaries live upon imbalances," unquote. Now, at one level, that's obvious because financial intermediaries and markets exist to match an imbalance between saving and investment at the level of one household or firm to an equivalent imbalance of the opposite sign in another household or firm in the economy. But the deeper sense in which this thriving took place in an international setting is that savers in one country lend their money to borrowers in another jurisdiction about whom they know next to nothing, but they feel safe in doing so because what they directly hold is an obligation of a large, well-known, globally active bank, which they assume to be safe. But Hogan and Pierce pointed out 30 years ago that a European entity raising dollars to fund a dollar balance sheet does not have automatic access to a lender of dollars of last resort in the event that market conditions change. Such an institution is therefore exposed to serious funding risk in a way that doesn't occur in purely local currency operations. The average Eurobank, so-called, when they wrote, had access to marks or francs, or today that would be euros, of their local central bank, or pounds in the case of British banks. But it couldn't be assumed that dollars, that francs or marks or euros or pounds can be easily swapped in times of duress for dollars. And in fact, this very phenomenon which they identified 30 years ago was at the heart of the crisis that began to unfold in 2007. It was in Europe where banks had and still have a structural need for dollar borrowing to fund US dollar denominated assets that market strains first appeared in August of that year. As the crisis intensified, the need for access to central bank funding in dollars required a number of central banks to enter into swap arrangements with the US Federal Reserve so that their domestic banks could borrow dollars secured by local currency collateral. And European banks were by far the largest users of these facilities. Up to about $400 billion was accessed from the Fed through the ECB and other European central banks at the peak in December 2008. Of course, it's also in Europe that we've seen the epicenter of the most recent phase of this crisis. In some respects, today's problems are a little bit different and perhaps more complex than those of 3 years ago. They arise from cross-border lending within a currency area that has a single money, but very divergent experiences in terms of fiscal discipline and productivity, and a region that lacks a well-developed capacity for intra-area transfers, that capacity being built more or less as we speak. Nonetheless, although in some respects the problems are different today, dollar funding for European banks has once again tightened up, and as we saw just last week, swap lines among major central banks to access dollars from the Fed have again been activated. That presumably is designed to slow down the speed of European bank deleveraging of dollar assets that otherwise would be forced to occur. So some of the same problems from 4 years ago are still with us, and these are things which in some respects Hogan and Pierce talked about 30 years ago. Lots of people have claimed to have predicted the financial crisis. I doubt that Warren Hogan, if he were here, would claim that he and Ivor Pierce predicted it in all its dimensions in that book 3 decades ago. I think they would claim that their saga of this mythical planet where international cross-border financing ultimately produced a crisis contained many, many relevant insights. I doubt that they fully appreciated the role that the financial institutions of the leading deficit country, that is the US, would play in creating risk and transferring it elsewhere. In their story, the key institutions were those of the country of Balancia, that is the country where the international accounts were balanced initially, rather than in the deficit country. I think they might have expected that the response of major central banks to the crisis that we've seen would have resulted in more inflation than it has so far. That may be a reflection of the inflationary times in which they wrote. After all, in those days, it seemed inconceivable that the deflationary problems of the 1930s could reemerge. And the example of Japan, which has been in deflation for more than a decade, had not by then, of course, occurred. Or perhaps they might have just expected the inflation still to be coming. And if they had thought that, they probably wouldn't be alone in that view. It's certain, though, that Warren Hogan would have been watching all these developments with interest. He would have been recognising certain things that he could have broadly predicted. And I suspect that he would have said that in that very dry, elliptical turn of phrase that he had. He would also surely have been observing things that would have surprised him, and he would have been thinking about how his view of the world therefore needed to change. And he would have been pondering, I think, the future of the international financial system. So in that vein, I want to use the remainder of the time I have to make a few observations in that area. The first of those is that there is an extensive program of regulatory reform underway. in an international setting, potentially the most far-reaching of those reforms is the set of proposals recently endorsed at the G20 summit to mitigate the problems posed by institutions that are thought to be too big to fail at an international level. These are otherwise known as globally systemically important financial institutions, or GSIFIs for short. Some 29 banks globally have been identified as fitting that criteria at present. Though the list isn't a fixed one, the idea here is that there are criteria and that banks can enter or leave that list over time. There will, in due course, be a framework for globally systemic insurance companies to be developed with parallel but not identical criteria to those for the banks. The intention of this policy is to make the failure of such entities less likely by requiring additional capital, but also to make the consequences of failure, should it happen, less dramatic by developing better tools to resolve entities that have failed or that are on the point of failure. The latter, in particular, is a very ambitious undertaking. It contains some potentially far-reaching components, including, not least, the ability to bail in, so-called, certain creditors to an institution which is on the point of failure, effectively turning them into shareholders. And the idea of that is to lessen the likelihood that taxpayers would be called upon in such a situation. That's a very bold idea. It's quite inventive. To make it work, though, would require considerable cooperation across jurisdictions at a time when, in a crisis, when everyone's instinct is to protect creditors and counterparties in their own jurisdiction. I don't know what Warren Hogan would have made of this. I suspect, though, that he would be wondering whether, if regulatory actions bind more heavily on one group of institutions, the relevant behaviour won't just end up migrating to other, less regulated places. Now, that possibility is well understood by the international regulatory community, which also has a regulatory agenda for so-called shadow banks. That's actually a critical point. I would offer the observation that if we can get through the next year or so without a major crisis and successfully implement the various reforms, and they might be big ifs, but if we can, the next financial crisis, whenever that is, may not occur in the same sorts of institutions as last time or this time, but different ones. It could well occur in institutions or markets that don't as yet exist. So the key thing in avoiding disastrous crises in the future is less the specifics of regulation or resolution, even though they are critical, but it's more having a clear understanding of the nature and extent of risk-taking behaviour in all its potential dimensions and locations. On my reading of Warren Hogan's work, I think he might have shared that view. Put in the simplest terms, we might ask, where is it that the financiers are apparently making easy money? In what areas of risk-taking are the profits large or at least expected to be large? Because there's a good chance that it's there, that given enough time, the likelihood of excesses is greatest. In Hogan and Pierce's book, financial institutions and their behaviour were seen as central to the build-up of imbalances. But of course, these institutions are in one sense merely facilitating flows of capital that are reflective of other phenomena, resulting from the collective behaviour of the actors in surplus and deficit countries. So in contemplating the future of the international financial system, reforming the regulation of institutions and understanding their behaviour will be key, but it will be of equal importance to understand the underlying behaviour of the entities in the real economies. The role of official capital flows in particular is one element of the post-crisis world that seems to me to be becoming quite prominent. Indeed, one of the most striking features of the international financial system is the size of official reserve assets that have been accumulated by the region that Hogan and Pierce would have labelled surplusia, that is, the countries which run persistent current account surpluses. In the early 1970s, the accumulation of US dollars by surplus countries made for problems of monetary control in some large reserve holders like West Germany. When the Bretton Woods system finally broke down, total foreign reserves of all countries amounted to about 2.5% of world GDP. West Germany's reserves at that time were about 7% of a year's worth of West German GDP. Well, to compare to today, total reserves in the world amount to 15% of global GDP, not 2 or 3%, and that's up from 10% only 5 years ago. China's reserves are close to 50% of China's annual GDP. Many other Asian countries have equivalent ratios around 30%, while in Latin America, in some countries, foreign exchange reserve holdings are typically in the 10 to 15% of GDP range. Now, there are a number of reasons behind that build-up. One of them is that high levels of energy prices have pushed up the reserve holdings of oil-exporting countries. And that is understandable if they are seeking to stretch out the income gain from high prices of a finite resource. The reserves of many Asian countries have risen to much higher levels post-1997 as a form of insurance against capital flow reversal. Indeed, the IMF advised this course of action after the crisis, advice which has been taken to heart perhaps a little more than the fund intended. I think one can understand the desire for self-insurance, and particularly among those Asian countries that had IMF programs in the late 1990s who felt that the cost of mutual insurance, which is what the IMF is giving you, were very onerous. But the self-insurance provided by large holdings of reserves is costly, particularly in the low interest rate environment we see in the major countries today. Trillions of dollars and euros held on behalf of the citizens of countries across Asia and other emerging countries are earning quite meager returns, and they are subject to increasing sovereign risk. So this cost of self-insurance is therefore becoming increasingly apparent. I think that trend will probably surely continue, as inevitably Asian productivity levels continue to increase relative to those in Western countries, and as their real exchange rates rise. Well, having large centres of high saving with portfolios that are, in some respects, overweight in foreign assets, assets whose return is low and whose value is likely to go down, measured in the currencies of the holders, amounts to something of a problem. Attempts by those holders to exit that position quickly would obviously be highly disruptive, to say the least, and that's one reason they don't attempt it, though there is a degree of reserve diversification underway. To paraphrase that old line, if I owe you a few billion dollars, I may have a problem. If I owe you a few trillion, your problem might be every bit as big as mine. So there is a long-term issue of portfolio rebalancing to be addressed here, as well as one of structural realignments of national price levels, which is to say real exchange rates. At the same time, though, there are increasing calls for the emerging economies with large surpluses and high holdings of reserves to play a part in assisting Western countries who are facing budgetary and banking sector problems. With the balance sheets of many of those countries already under pressure, there's hope for contributions from large reserve holders who, after all, are the ones with the cash. It has to be observed, surely, that pressing reserve-heavy emerging economies to lend into structures designed to smooth adjustment processes in the advanced world really amounts to a call to perpetuate, to a fair extent at least, and for a bit longer at least, some of the very imbalances, so-called, that so many have lamented for so long. What people are really saying in these calls is that they want to move only quite slowly away from the current constellation of resource flows and prices that in other discussions have been seen as constituting the problem. Now, that may well be the best approach. In fact, I think it probably is the best approach to seek to adjust gradually. But it is observable at the same time that the large foreign reserve holding countries are already getting uncomfortable with their degree of exposure to major Western governments. Hence, any offers of assistance they make are likely to be made with a careful eye to risk minimisation. That's likely to mean, in turn, that they will prefer to operate through the international institutions, such as the IMF, where the risk you take is IMF risk rather than the risk of any particular sovereign. Alternatively, these countries may prefer to take hard assets in return for their cash rather than financial IOUs. And that in turn could easily raise the social and political tension level. At the very least, anyway, in my opinion, managing all this over the next decade will require very level-headed analysis, far-sighted decisions on the part of national policymakers, and a degree of international cooperation much greater than we ordinarily see. Moreover, there will be some very important questions to be confronted. Not least of those will be that, with the relative economic weight of the emerging world rising quite quickly and their financial weight coming along quite closely behind, they will expect an increased role in global financial governance as a condition of accepting more obligations to contribute to the global common good. So the willingness of the established post-war leadership countries to cede a degree of status and control to the emerging world will need to increase at the same speed as the emerging countries' willingness to grasp and accept their rising responsibilities. Will that occur? Well, I think that's hard to judge. Much will depend on whether the various parties have the same general idea about the purpose of the international monetary system. And that is, at least at this point, not clear. Another thing we might see, I think, is a certain tendency towards the financial repression that was a feature of the post-war world in which Warren Hogan first began to study economics. A legacy of the 1930s, of course, was a much tighter regulatory regime for banks, and that many aspects of that stayed in place for decades, really right through to the 1980s in Australia. A legacy of the 1940s, as a result of the conflict there, was a very large stock of government debt. Debt to GDP ratios actually went well into triple digits for many countries, including Australia, US, UK, France, and others at that time. Yet from the 1950s through to the 70s, debt servicing dynamics were kept within manageable bounds. The rapid growth in economic output in the long post-war boom, of course, helped that, and that was aided by favourable demographics and strong productivity growth. But also contributing was a combination of central banks holding down long-term interest rates, largely at government direction, and banks and other entities being forced to hold the very large, a significant chunk anyway, of the large stock of debt that was on issue. And of course, at the end of that boom, there was a period of unanticipated high inflation, which also helped to lower ratios of debt to GDP. Contrast some of these things to the current era, where the rapid output growth is likely going to be in the countries that don't have very much government debt, but do have productivity catch-up working for them. Conversely, in many of the countries that do have a lot of government debt, growth is likely to be constrained, not least because demographics are going to be going the wrong way. So it seems to me conceivable that with slow-growing countries feeling pressed for solutions, regulatory actions of various kinds might have certain attractions. Given that, and given that many emerging countries have mixed feelings about the merits of free financial markets anyway, it seems to me quite conceivable that the current trend towards more assertive and intrusive regulation of finance, occurring as it is for understandable reasons, might end up going a good deal further than presently contemplated. And, of course, the potential for an outcome that eventually, at some point, involves significant inflation is obvious. While I've only touched on the surface of many of these things, as I said earlier, I'm not sure what Warren would have made of these matters, whether he would agree with my views or not. I am sure, though, that he would have thought them worthy of further discussion and that he would have contributed very actively to that discussion. So hopefully I've succeeded in at least stimulating a little bit of discussion this evening. Once again, I want to thank the university and the Hogan family for giving me the honour of presenting this lecture, and I hope it marks the start of a successful series. Thank you very much.
Hi. Before I ask the question, I just want to disclose that I've got shares in BlueScope and OneSteel. What I wanted to say was I actually follow the UK Guardian newspaper, and in their online articles, they've been bemoaning the hollowing out of the manufacturing industry in the UK and the fact that from Thatcher onwards and accelerated by Blair, the manufacturing industry in the UK was decimated. And as you pointed out, they've had quantitative easing now, but that doesn't help because they've got no manufacturing to benefit from it. Now, when you look at the apex of world manufacturing, you've got Germany, Japan and Switzerland. Germany is fine with its currency because the euro is held down by other European countries that are weaker than Germany compared to what the Deutschmark would be. And Switzerland and Japan actively intervene in their foreign exchange markets to keep their currency down. What I wanted to know, you mentioned in your lecture that during a GFC, every country's out there to protect its own patch, but Australia seems to be the only country in the world that doesn't care about its own patch. And with the currency being as it is, I'm just worried in 20 years' time, the Sydney Morning Herald's going to say, oh, we had a manufacturing industry 20 years ago, and now that China bubbles burst and the currency's at 60 cents, there's no one out there to make things and benefit from this. What you thought of what I just said?
I'm not going to... Let me respond to a couple of things there. I think the Australian authorities acted effectively to protect our patch, as you put it, in terms of the main threat, which was to keep the financial system running well. I think we succeeded in that. And I think it's apparent, isn't it, that overall the economy's come through in far better shape than most. As I've said many times, I'm yet to meet a central bank governor from another country with whom I want to swap. On the demise of manufacturing, this has long been talked about, but manufacturing is still here. It's been declining as a share of GDP in every country in the advanced world for 50 years. That's still happening, and a lot of it has shifted to Asia, but our economy has found other profitable things to do in various other sectors, most of which are actually not mining. It's still the case that mining share of output wouldn't be materially larger than manufacturing's right now, even with the boom we've been having. It probably will grow, of course, from here. But I think the demise of manufacturing has long been predicted, yet to occur, and my guess is we'll still have a manufacturing sector in the future, but it will look different, and it won't necessarily be populated by all the same firms that we grew up with. But this is a phenomenon that happens all over the world.
Thank you. So I won't disclose any holding in shares. However, I am by profession an investment banker, and one of my passions is investing into innovation. And I'd like to get your thoughts on the tension with the Basel III Accords between safer banking, which often basically means moving into investing in mortgages or securities in large listed companies, against the risks that you inherently take by investing in things that are new and innovative. It does mean that your shadow banking sector becomes the main vehicle of funding for the innovation that's driving the next generation of growth. So could I have any thoughts around that tension?
It's certainly the case that the Basel changes are designed to ensure that capital that banks hold is better calibrated to the risk they're really running. And the reason for that is that stating what everyone knows, that there was nothing like enough capital in some of these very large global banks anyway for some of the risks that they were running. In the thrust of what you're saying is correct in the sense that more risky activities will have to hold appropriate capital, but I think that is the bank supervisor's responsibility, given that we present banks to the community as a fixed nominal obligation deposit. There's regulation for safety and so on. So I think there's no real alternative to doing that. But that doesn't mean that there's no funding for innovation. There are other entities that do that, and frankly, they're probably going to be more effective at it than many an average bank would be. So I'm not sure that it really cuts off innovation seriously, unless we were to go overboard in trying to trying to regulate every single piece of shadow banking that exists, which I personally don't think we should do. I think there's a role for high-risk private equity type activity out there, and I don't think it's the business of the government to try to regulate that too much, while ever the people who are putting money into that are sophisticated investors who understand the risk they're taking. So it seems to me there's still a role for all those things. Admittedly, we don't want to over-regulate them. I certainly agree with that.
My question is, does the Basel Committee agree with the analysis of the US Commission into the 2008 financial crisis as the cause of the crisis, where they identify the cause as a failure of risk management and corporate governance rather than liquidity or solvency, which seems to be the main focus of the committee's work and bank and regulators around the world? And if and the US Commission is really saying that what we do in Australia, what is best practice corporate governance, has been a failure and is the cause of the crisis. Does the Basel Committee agree with that analysis?
I wouldn't want to speak for the Basel Committee. I'm not a member of it. But I think my perspective would be, you know, enough went wrong in the past 3 or 4 years that there's plenty of blame to be shared around, and I think it's probably the case that most thoughtful people would point to a number of things that went wrong. I think certainly in certain respects governance was weak. I think that would be more a US phenomenon than in some other countries. But there was clearly not enough capital. There were clearly distorted incentives for many of the people running the business. There was clearly not enough attention paid to liquidity funding risk, and so on. I mean, there are a number of things that went wrong, as there almost always is in a major disaster. There'll be a string of things which combine to create the problem, and I personally would not feel comfortable saying it was all due to factor X. There was Y, Z, A, B, and C as well, and I think that's probably the most sensible way to think about the causes.
Mr. Glenn Stevens, thank you very much for your interesting and, I would say, an inspiring speech. As an alumni of this university, as it shows horizons of our future possible contribution to the society, I've got two questions. First is related to your reference to your professor who was separating coins. In this turbulent time, which foreign currency is the most trustworthy from your perspective in this unstable currency
basket?
Apart from
the Australian dollar, very trustworthy.
Yes, foreign currency. And second question, when you were referring to the possible predictions of Warren Hogan with regards to the financial crisis, you've said that most likely he would highlight the role of US. But my question is related to the largest US debt and whether this bubble actually could be predicted. Thank you.
Well, I'm not going to get into currency advice. I'm not a licensed financial advisor, so that's the excuse I'll offer there. Was the second question, could the bubble have been predicted?
And the contribution of
the US. Well, there was a very long, for many years, for much of my professional life as an economist, actually, people were bemoaning the United States current account deficit. And they were saying, this is going to end badly, and, you know, it will be terrible. Now, I think that It's certainly true that cross-border flows into the US from other countries that had an effect on the pricing of credit to America, and then what America did with that credit, and then how they parceled the risk off to others, that certainly was central to this whole business. But I would have to say that much of what we used to read about the way in which the US current account would bring us all undone, it hasn't brought us undone in the way people were thinking about it all, in my opinion. I mean, we haven't had a total collapse of the US dollar, and people, at least not so far, refusing to fund the US balance of payments position. In fact, what we've had is, in recent times, the dollar's fine, the US government is still borrowing at 2% for 10 or 20 years, and people run to US debt when problems happen elsewhere in the world. So, you know, many commentators fingered the US balance of payments as kind of the most likely source of risk, but in a way it was, but it didn't manifest. The problem didn't manifest in the way that most of those people were expecting, I don't think. This was mainly about inadequate pricing for risk and all the distorted incentive and so on that I referred to a moment ago. And there were certainly people who, in the international official sector, for some years said, risk pricing is too cheap, there's something wrong here, this is not going to end well, but they couldn't tell you exactly how and where and when it was going to unfold. They could just see that risk pricing was too cheap, interest money was too cheap for various reasons, for too long. And given enough time, if money's really cheap for a long time, people will ultimately probably find a way of doing something silly with it. And there you have it.
Warren Hogan, Jr. On behalf of my mother and my family, Glenn, I'd like to thank you for tonight's speech. I, too, am not sure what my father would say, but I think he would definitely feel the effort an excellent one. I do have a question, as Warren Hogan, Chief Economist of ANZ Bank. You talked about and suggested maybe a little bit more regulation on the way, and I look forward to reading the text, and this debate has got a long way to go. The comparable historical event in economic and financial terms is probably the 1930s, and the policy mistakes that were made then were fairly vanilla macro policy mistakes around interest rates and trade policy and fiscal policy. And so far in the last few years, as a global community, we've done pretty well not to make those mistakes and, in fact, do the opposite and salvage something from this, at least not cause a full depression-type environment. But I do worry that maybe the policy mistake we do make this time around is over-regulation. And I say that, and I'd be interested in your views on it, and I'm just taking it as a piece of discussion, is a hallmark of the 30s was a rise in precautionary savings, and I think that's a hallmark of what's going on now, whether you look at it in terms of, as you noted, the foreign exchange reserves, the household sector in many countries, and of course the banking system. So is there a risk if we over-regulate the banking sector in particular that that they'll constrain their lending and we won't get the economy going again?
Well, I'll take that as a question from an economist rather than from a banker, Warren. I think there was always bound to be some changes to regulation, which the regulators will label as reform, because I think we came to see certain inadequacies of the previous system. I suppose, personally, I have seen a couple of risks in the way we've been proceeding. One is that Basel II took 20 years to negotiate and bring in. Basel III took 18 months. There's a lot of people have worked incredibly hard to try to make that make Basel III correct and effective, but when we're going this fast, one always worries about the possible risk that you introduce some unintended consequence. That's always something for me to be kept in mind in regulatory reform. So that's one thing that I think we need to be careful of. I think we also we need to be realistic about what regulation can really achieve, because we do not want to make, in my opinion anyway, the banking system so completely risk averse and so totally. We don't want to make it so risk-averse that it fails to do its proper job for the economy, to echo the earlier question. Right now, probably the problem in many countries is more likely to be not so much people taking too much risk as not taking enough, and we need to strike an appropriate balance there. And they're the sorts of arguments that we in Australia have consistently made. The international backdrop you're working with, though, is that in a number of countries, not our own, but a number of countries, a lot of public money had to go into stabilising the banking system. And it's inevitable, once that happens, that the populace and the political process is going to want to make some changes to the regulatory setup. I think there's no way of avoiding that. The trick is to make those changes productive and worthwhile. And those of us who are engaging with the international community on this, that's basically what we're trying to do. So there's always some risk of regulatory overkill. I think there was, looking back, some countries would say, well, the light touch went too far. It was too light. We need to find the happy medium, and actually the thoughtful bankers will support that, because they know that for the industry's long-term viability and reputation, the appropriate extent of regulatory oversight is what you need. I think it's just that precinct of Martin Place where we are being nice and level. We just leave them alone. They leave us alone, mainly. I think there are probably many people who don't fully understand what the Reserve Bank does, but that's a topic for another day.
Thank you. Governor, perhaps it's an observation more than anything, but it seems as though, is it deficitia has won the debate, particularly after Bernanke's savings glut speech. We tend to want to blame the savings economies without focusing enough on the way that capital markets make investment decisions in the deficit countries. And in particular, I think the way that over the last 10 years we've seen very low corporate investment in the US, very low government investment. We are being provided with the capital we need to make these investments, but aside from the household sector in the US making quite stupid decisions in places like Nevada, we're not seeing the investment we need in productive capacity in Western economies, despite very low interest rates.
Well, as John Clark said parodying me on TV, I take that as a comment. I think the most nuanced way to think about what caused all this isn't just to blame the surplus countries, but I think at the same time it isn't sensible just to blame the deficit countries either. I mean, there was a mutual process here where for various reasons, there was a lot of saving pushed into the international financial system that bids down the price of capital. And what's going to happen when the price of capital gets really cheap? The countries most responsive to that, which would be basically the Anglo world, including us, say, thanks a lot, that's cheap capital, I will use that. The key question then is how well you use it, and some of it, obviously, as you say, was not well used, and therein is the problem. We had a financial system that kept looking for ways to do business, and once they've lent to all the good borrowers, you find some other borrowers who are not so good and so on. But so I think the behaviour of the financial sector, the efforts of the Anglo countries to try to maintain, you know, full employment and price stability, combined with the saving behaviour of the others, it was inevitable you were going to get these kind of capital flows. On investment in the US, actually the US corporate sector is in very good shape at the moment, and I thought the data is showing that investment is starting to pick up there. I think public investment, anybody who's travelled in the US would probably agree that the state of their public infrastructure is inadequate. And, well, it took me 40 minutes to drive 4 kilometres to get here tonight. Perhaps this is not necessarily unknown in our own country. They're important issues about which we need a sensible conversation, but I can't do it right now.
Okay, one last question.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. My question is about the role of the Reserve Bank, and it seems to me that 12 to 18 months ago, all businesses in Australia, and certainly each individual, had a very high degree of confidence that once the Reserve Bank made a decision on interest rates, that interest rate decision would flow through. And that perception underpinned a lot of decisions that individuals and businesses made and make in terms of their investment decisions, both in terms of their homes and, of course, as I said, businesses. Now, of course, during the last 12 months, we've seen the four major banks in particular make their own decisions in terms of where they pass on those Reserve Bank decisions. So in a sense, it seems to me what we're seeing is a delegation of control of monetary policy to the four major banks. And I'm wondering if there might be a role or, a need for the four major banks to actually justify to the Reserve Bank if they wish to make an alternative decision other than pass on that interest rate adjustment, and therefore give the Reserve Bank greater oversight of monetary policy.
I'm not going to come at the current controversy over what's happening in the last 48 hours. I would observe that the period in which announced changes in mortgage rates tracks the cash rate decision, actually, that hasn't been the case since time immemorial. It was an unusual period of history, and if you go back a long way, that wasn't the norm. We've tended to somehow come to feel that it was the norm, but in the broader sweep of history, the connections were not as close as that. The other comment I would make, and I've said this countless times, it's usually ignored, but yes, the spread between the cash rate and most loan rates has risen up until now at least by something around 100 basis points since the middle of 2007. And for that reason, the cash rate is roughly 100 points lower than it would otherwise have been because we've basically offset that widening. We can't do that, you know, to the nearest basis point for every borrower, but roughly speaking, we have broadly offset that 100 or point so change in the margin with a setting of our instrument that's appropriate to give the overall conditions that we thought were right. I notice that no one pays attention to that point, but that is in fact facts. Okay.